Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, we'll continue the series Big Ag U, taking a look at potential conflicts that can arise when universities accept big money from ag corporations. We'll listen to a professor who feels the educational system doesn't do enough to teach the history of Native Americans. An art exhibit explores themes of a famous play set in Chicago. We'll hear from the curator. Also, gun violence can be deadly, but it's also traumatic for those who survive. We'll talk with some of them. And a longtime lobbyist in Springfield is retiring. He reflects on what he's seen in a half century under the Statehouse dome. Those stories and more coming up this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, does the educational system do enough to tell the stories of Native Americans? Many say no. Surviving gun violence. A lot of the victims who are traumatized carry that with them their entire lives. And we hear from a woman who saw a safety problem and did something about it. That's all ahead on Statewide. Well, back in 2013, the largest farmland asset manager in the world made a $5 million gift to the University of Illinois to establish a research center. And as part of our series Big Ag U, Dana Cronin reports on how the center was founded to study the very area of investment where the company has few rivals and has wandered into controversy.
You probably know TIAA as a manager of retirement accounts. It's a huge player in that market.
In over 100 years, we've never missed a payment. Guaranteed monthly income for life.
And part of that giant investment portfolio is farmland. Because as it turns out, farmland is a really good investment. It's stable and tends to increase in value year to year. And as the saying goes, they're not making any more of it. So farmland is increasingly viewed as a commodity, something to be bought, sold, or rented. And the TIAA Center for Farmland Research, housed at the University of Illinois, is evidence of that. The $5 million donation that made the think tank possible is the fourth largest corporate gift the university's agriculture department has received in the last 10 years. That's according to data obtained by Harvest Public Media and Investigate Midwest through the Freedom of Information Act. Bruce Sherrick is a professor of farmland economics and the center's director.
When people ask me what I do, I say I'm interested in anything that affects farmland values. Anything that affects farmland values. Who does that matter to? Anyone who cares about farmland values.
He says that's not just the center's benefactor.
That's farmers. That's investors. That's input dealers. That's crop insurance people.
But some say focusing on farmland as just a commodity puts investors over the communities that rely on the land. Gabrielle McNally leads an initiative at American Farmland Trust that supports women landowners. She says corporate investment in farmland drives up the cost of the land, and that can make it harder for new people to own farmland.
And it is, by and large, women and folks of color who kind of make up this sort of the new and beginning farmer group.
Research also shows that conservation often falls by the wayside on plots of farmland owned by corporations. TIAA has also come under fire for working with a land grabber to acquire some of their Brazilian farmland. That's led some of TIAA's own clients to speak out, like University of Iowa anthropology professor Laura Graham. Her research focuses on indigenous communities in Brazil. Her retirement account, managed by TIAA.
And so it's very ironic that my own retirement is supporting something that my research and my work with communities is in direct opposition to.
So she and other University of Iowa faculty demanded transparency and accountability from the investment giant. TIAA declined comment for this story. Sherrick, head of the TIAA Center for Farmland Research back at the University of Illinois, says that controversy hadn't surfaced yet when the university received the gift. But he says that no-strings-attached corporate gift created a model for universities to dedicate themselves to research in perpetuity.
State funding had gone away. Federal funding had gone away. Our extension program finances have gone virtually completely away, so we're substituting for those other sources.
Others say this corporate model leaves out rural communities that schools also need to serve.
You know, we need to be looking at farm policies which would strengthen small-scale farmers and make land more accessible to them.
Doug Hertzler is a senior policy analyst with ActionAid USA.
People that have a worldview that playing the market is what matters aren't thinking about the well-being of those rural communities.
Hertzler says creating more of these corporate university research partnerships could ultimately hurt those whose livelihoods depend on farmland, farmers. I'm Dana Cronin, Harvest Public Media.
It's becoming harder to get tax dollars to fix up agricultural schools at public universities. It's even harder to find public money to build new facilities, but the farming industry is stepping in. Katie Pikus and Seth Bodine report on the growing ties between agribusiness and college campuses.
The heavy hum of construction equipment reflects millions spent to build a feed mill tower in Ames, Iowa. The project promises a working feed mill and ways to use that in both research and training. It'll crank out about 20,000 tons of feed a year, and it costs $24 million to build. But Iowa State University and taxpayers aren't paying a dime. Private donors are picking up the tab, notably agribusinesses. Charles Herberg is an Iowa State University agricultural engineering professor. He says the facility will run like a business and hopefully draw more students to milling.
And that's one of the target areas that we want to meet, is to be able to help those people get onboarded into companies and even existing staff of companies, bringing them up to speed with new technologies.
This privately funded facility fits with a trend. Ag schools at public universities increasingly pull in money from industry and other private sources as legislatures grow less willing to chip in tax dollars. The practice builds stronger relationships with the farm-related industries where many of the school's graduates will want to work. But critics worry those ties could turn work at universities that puts industry needs above a broader public interest. Emma Schmidt is with Food and Water Watch.
And just in general, agribusiness as it stands right now is, you know, it's not about the small farmer. It's not about rural communities in, across Iowa. It's about Wall Street. It's about making a profit.
State tax dollars to Iowa State decreased 19% in the last dozen years. Funding from agribusinesses makes big projects like the feed mill possible. Ray Klein is the director of the Office of Partnerships for the Ag College.
I consider it critical, and I consider it in some ways a reinforcement of the relationship that we have in place with all of our industry partners.
For other states like Oklahoma, where funding has been cut more than 30% between 2008 and 2018, money from private donors is a necessity. Michael Leachman is with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He tracks trends in state policy.
Even going into the pandemic, funding still remained well below pre-Great Recession levels in most states. And in many states, the funding cuts were severe.
Agriculture departments across 97 universities have an $11.5 billion backlog in repairs. And many researchers are stuck with older, crumbling labs. Peter Reeves collected data for the study. He says that money has gone toward new buildings over investing in old ones.
And so then what we ultimately are left with is this situation where, you know, we have aging out infrastructure that has been underinvested in for years, and the cost of waiting is starting to catch up with these campuses.
Some researchers at Oklahoma State University work in outdated buildings that haven't been upgraded, and that affects their research. Plant and soil sciences professor Brett Carver spends his time breeding wheat inside greenhouses that were built in the 1950s. He says it's like,
we're trying to race or perform in an Indy 500. In 2021 with a car that would have been manufactured in the 50s. We can do things. We can soup up that car to maybe try to keep up, but we're going to eventually pay the price for that.
And they did pay the price. When a winter storm hit, the greenhouses got too cold. Carver says that could put him up to a year behind on his research. University officials say Carver's greenhouses are on the list of funding priorities. They're soliciting private and corporate sponsors to raise roughly $15 million to build new ones. And for Iowa State's feed mill, the Ag College plans to seek out state, federal, and private funds for research. Wherever universities get their funds, trends show they'll continue to look for money from agribusiness. Katie Pikus, Harvest Public Media.
This reporting part of the investigative series Big Ag U by Harvest Public Media and Investigate Midwest, taking a look at corporate influence on public universities across the Midwest. We have links to that reporting at our website at nprillinois.org. Just look for statewide. The history and contemporary culture of Native Americans doesn't receive the attention it deserves. That's according to Pam Silas. She heads Community Outreach and Engagement for Northwestern University's Center for Native American and Indigenous Research. Silas says 84% of K-12 schools in North America only cover pre-1900 Native American issues, and that's if they cover the subject at all. She spoke with Sarah Nardi.
So most of America thinks we're vanished, we're gone, we're invisible. And so you know, here we have these vibrant, live communities still working, going to school, raising families under the umbrella of sovereignty, tribal sovereignty, and Americans don't even know we exist. So that's kind of the perceptions. And then, you kind of go across the spectrum from either the vanishing race of yesteryear or this romantic notion that we're all tree hugging, spiritual, we still wear braids and feathers. So there's just, it's really not an accurate portrayal of today's contemporary communities.
So it sounds like you're saying Native cultures are either relegated to the past or treated as this monolithic, idealized stereotype of what we think Native cultures to be.
Very stereotypical of how, movies and, of course, mascots have, that's been the primary form of representation.
So how do you go about changing those perceptions and educating people so as to possibly change their minds?
Well, I think, along with the Black Lives Matter movement, which has been typical in history when a social justice issue led by communities of color gets elevated, we get elevated along with them. And I appreciate that. I appreciate that as the public becomes more aware, there's a genuine interest in learning more. And so I think then becomes the next part of the challenge, which is really how to, in a large enough scale, get better information out there. And you can see that that is happening. There's been a couple of new series, one on Peacock called Rutherford Falls and all Native writing staff. And another one's come out, Res Dogs, which is being streamed on Hulu. And so now you have, thank you. We're adding to the body of America's experience with Native communities in a contemporary setting. And the humor and the fun and the, political challenges, the socioeconomic challenges, the realities, like everyone living in America.
Popular culture can be really instructive in, broadening people's perspectives and changing people's minds. What other ways are there to reach out to people and, in a lot of cases, introduce contemporary Native American culture in a broader sense?
Well, I think, just kind of questioning what you do know, being a little bit more critical of what is being taught in the school. I hope that people are asking questions, and when they see those stereotypes challenge, I feel like in my lifetime, right, I'm a grandmother now, but when I was young raising children, it was quite popular to do Pilgrims and Indians during, Thanksgiving. And I think now it's changing, and that they're actually teachers maybe are pushing this more than textbooks or hard curriculum, but they're challenging that. And I think parents are asking more questions about it. So I say we may have to do a little bit more homework ourselves. And I just encourage everyone to do that. And there are, with the internet now, and of course, coming out of COVID and all of the new resources that ended up accessible through the internet, there's great resources out there for people to tap into. It wouldn't take much.
We've seen a lot of school board meetings kind of devolve into chaos over things like critical race theory. Do you sense a hesitancy or a resistance on the part of people to accept changes to the curriculum as it relates to Native American culture?
You know, I can't say that I've worked recently on those issues. I've seen an evolution of, rather than just say we want two paragraphs in a history book that talk about the past and Native Americans, we're really talking about integrating difference into modern day culture. Like, for instance, there are so many great Native American scientists and engineers that are working in all sectors of the field in engineering and science. And their contributions come very creatively from a very different experience in America. So, right, companies value different perspectives. That's what makes innovation happen. And so I feel like we're not just looking at a packaged, like, let me give you a picture of our culture and our past, but more about respecting each other enough and being open enough to a variety of ways of knowing, that that creativity, that solutions, that inclusivity can actually better the lives of all human beings.
And you mentioned COVID, and we've heard a lot about the disproportionate effects on minority communities like African-American communities and Hispanic communities. What's been the experience of the Native American community?
Oh, it's been devastating. Almost every single person has had either direct, you know, family loss or, you know, our communities, which are very tightly knit. It's been very difficult. And that's because of years of disinvestment in healthcare, with high rates of diabetes and heart conditions, all kinds of things. And I saw some numbers recently. I'm not going to remember them exactly, but they were comparing the dollar amount that we spend per year, per person. You know, in the Indian health system, it's like $3,000 versus general America, $12,000 versus someone who's in the correctional system, $9,000. It's ridiculously low. And so Natives have been, you know, suffering health disparities for a long time. So we're extremely vulnerable once the pandemic hit.
That's Pam Silas. She heads community outreach and engagement for Northwestern University's Center for Native American and Indigenous Research. And she talked with Sarah Nardi. Well, coming up, a man who became his brother's caregiver has written a book on his experience. Stay with us. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Well, before Rob Fromberg became a writer and a teacher, he was a 19-year-old from Peoria, abruptly thrust into the role of full-time caretaker for his younger brother. That relationship is the focal point of Fromberg's new memoir, How to Walk with Steve. And he spoke about it with Tim Shelley.
When Rob became Steve's full-time guardian in 1980, there wasn't much help available for him.
My brother Steve has autism. So as you can imagine, or possibly not, at the time he was born in the early 60s, you know, autism was not a household word like it is now. It took years for him to even be diagnosed as having autism. It was still very much unknown, even among clinicians. But he was nonverbal for a long time. He ran and ran and ran. Very hyperactive. I never saw him walk until he was about 16 years old, just ran. And as we grew up, I often took care of Steve for various reasons. And then my parents died very young. So my father died in 77, late 77. My mother died in 1980. And so when I returned from New York, I was the guardian of my brother. And so the fair amount of the book is to childhood, a young person's point of view of seeing autism, relating to a close family member with autism, being unable to really understand how to cope with somebody who had such severe behavior problems, and then also moving into young adulthood and really assuming a parental role.
Fromberg's lived in big cities, but in many ways, he says Peoria was the most impactful place he ever lived.
The other theme in the book I'd love to emphasize is Peoria specifically. So the original title of this book was Peoria. Peoria is sort of a metaphor for the entire story of my life. To be in a, my parents were both artists, which was very atypical in a very conservative 1960s, early 1970s, Peoria, Illinois. Most of the kids, practically all of the kids' parents worked at Caterpillar or Hiram Walker or Pabst. And you know, here was me. My father taught, was an abstract expressionist painter and an experimental filmmaker teaching at Bradley. And as for me, I was interested in Andy Warhol and the Velvet Underground and New York City. So I felt very frustrated too, got out as soon as I could. But at the end of the book, you see a real resolution around the beauty and the joy of growing up somewhere where you are special and you are a little bit different. And that is something that over a lifetime, I found a way to nurture. So that's an important theme in the book.
Peoria was also vital for Steve, who can draw an accurate map of Peoria freehand from memory. Though he now lives in North Carolina, Steve and Rob still come back to visit.
And that's the end of the book is one of Steve and my return trips to Peoria and kind of going through all of our old sites. And then he shows me one site that was very important to him, very important to me, very important to my father that I had forgotten about. And he and I had never seen together. And that's the final scene of the book. So Peoria, my brother, is just the most important place in the world.
That site's not one of the usual must visits in Peoria, but it holds a lot of meaning for both of them.
It's a side door that goes into WEEK TV. It was, I believe, it was the employee entrance, my father used to hand off film to be developed there. And then get back the film that had been developed. And so it was just an odd little memory of that moment.
That's Rob Fromberg. His memoir, How to Walk with Steve, focuses on his relationship with his younger brother, who has autism. Fromberg became his brother's full-time guardian in 1980 when he was just 19. Illinois residents are quitting their jobs in high numbers during the pandemic, and Peter Medlin reports on a new classification of jobs highly in demand. They're called new-collar jobs.
New-collar refers to new tech-focused jobs that are often high-paying but don't rely on a conventional four-year college career path. Nikisha Stepney is the Executive Dean for Business, Technology, and Workforce Education at Waubonsie Community College. She says national trends and a community needs assessment guide its investment in these programs.
Right now, there's 15,838 jobs related to cybersecurity open in the state of Illinois. There's no reason why high school students are not made aware of this career pathway. There's no reason why those that are looking for a career change, because we serve those.
She says it's common for cybersecurity or automotive technology students to earn a credential in a year or two and make close to six figures or more right out of the gate. Community college enrollment took a major hit during the pandemic, but Stepney says they're offering more welding and cybersecurity courses than ever due to demand. The college recently renovated an entire campus to focus on these types of programs. I'm Peter Medlin.
Governor J.B. Pritzker's administration's pushing to overhaul how nursing homes in Illinois are paid with state Medicaid dollars in order to incentivize a better quality of care. But the state's largest nursing home industry group says making increased reimbursements contingent on staffing, something facilities have struggled with even before the pandemic, is unfair. Matt Pickering is with the Healthcare Council of Illinois. He claims the Department of Public Health, which oversees nursing homes, has created a cycle wherein the agency cites facilities for violations, levies costly fines, but doesn't help offending nursing homes improve their protocols. Governor Pritzker's Department of Health Care and Family Services wants to increase reimbursements to nursing homes, something the industry has been calling for, but would achieve that in part by levying higher taxes on unoccupied beds in those facilities. The nursing home industry is warning of a wave of facility closures possible in Illinois. There's been a lot of focus on gun violence in Chicago, and we often think of that violence in terms of murders, but it actually minimizes the problem. For every person killed in a Chicago shooting, 5 are shot and survive, and those victims are marked for life. Patrick Smith at WBEZ talked with a survivor to see how she's coping.
Aisha Lowe and her friend survived a shooting together, but their friendship didn't make it. The two were walking through a field next to a school in the West Garfield Park neighborhood. Lowe's friend was walking her home. The two were lost in conversation, reminiscing about funny memories when it happened.
She was walking me halfway. We was talking about how we used to be in school, getting on people's nerves. Yeah, we weren't paying no attention at first, but I saw the car when it was pulling up, but I didn't know if it was going to shoot or not.
Lowe says she saw the car, but she didn't see the other group of people across the field, the people they were aiming at. Suddenly, Lowe and her friend were caught in the middle of a shootout.
Somebody pulled those stars shooting, then they were shooting back, and we was in the crossfire.
Lowe says neither group saw the two teenage girls stuck in the middle because it was night and the park is lined with trees. Lowe's heart dropped, and she panicked when she heard the first shot.
I ain't know which way to run, so I'm like, which way to run? I was so short, I ain't know which way to run through the park lot. I ain't know which way to run.
Lowe's friend got shot twice in the arm. One of the bullets hit Lowe in the knee. At first, she didn't even realize she was shot.
My leg felt hot. I'm like, why my leg feeling hot? I looked down at my knee, I rubbed, why my knee bleeding?
The two called some friends who picked them up and rushed them to a nearby hospital. When I spoke with her 3 months later, Lowe had just gotten the bullet removed from her leg. She holds up her cell phone to show a picture of the bullet after it was removed. It sits on a white pad that's marked with little streaks of her blood.
They just took it, I guess, that's on my leg. It hurt.
Lowe says she isn't really angry with the people who shot her. She says she knows they weren't shooting at her, and there's no way they could have known she was there when they started shooting at each other.
It was the shooting happened so quick, it was like, ain't seen nobody. It was so quick.
Yeah, but if they weren't shooting at each other, you would never have gotten shot.
Right. Probably if I wasn't walking right there in the crossfire, if I wasn't knew they was finna shoot, I could have went another way, but I didn't know they were gonna start shooting.
It's heartbreaking to hear Lowe talk about her being hit by a stray bullet as if it's the result of her own choices. Instead of blaming the people doing the shooting or the conditions that left her community awash in gun violence, Lowe blames herself. She also blames the friend she was with. Lowe says when the shot started, her friend grabbed her and crouched behind her.
She used me as her shield. She put me in front of her. I'm like, what you grabbing me for? I'm like, I'm not nobody's shield.
Lowe says since then, she doesn't consider her a friend at all.
We don't talk no more. We don't touch the last.
It's part of Lowe's increasing isolation since the shooting.
Well, before, I used to be outside on the porch, kicking and talking, chilling. But I don't go outside no more since I got shot. I don't go outside. I stay in the house.
She says in the weeks after, she would just sit in her room alone and cry. She didn't want to come out.
Now I don't think about it so much. So I really don't think about it. I think about it sometimes, but not all the time. I used to be sitting in my room just thinking. I used to think a lot, then I used to cry. Now it's like, I was just thinking about how it was. It was so fast. I was thinking about a lot of stuff.
One of the things she would turn over in her head is the idea that it was some sort of cosmic justice that she got shot, that the random bullet intended for someone else hit her as punishment for her talking back to her mom and getting in trouble in high school.
I feel like karma came back and taught me a lesson, I guess. It felt like by me being disrespectful to my mama, that happened to me. So that's what I was thinking about when I used to go in my room.
Lowe says she knows now that it wasn't her fault. It wasn't karma. Now she thinks of it like she was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. But of course, she was just walking home through a park with a friend. The shooting has left her afraid of her own neighborhood. It's made her wary of strange cars and people she doesn't know. She says she only hangs out with her sister and cousin now. She doesn't want to be around strangers because they could be the target of a shooting and she could get caught in the middle. Any passing car could have a shooter inside.
I don't even go to the park no more since I used to be in the park all the time with my cousin doing stuff. I don't do that no more. Like, I don't be at the park no more. And that area where I live at is really dangerous over there. So I don't like a lot, I like a crowd of people around me. since I got shot. I'd be scared. Because you don't know who the people that can drive. I just don't. That's why every time I see a car where I ain't never see right through my block, I just be best for me just going now. People don't, they don't care nowadays now. So they just shoot anybody.
Patrick Smith with that report. The acronym BIPOC stands for Black, Indigenous, and People of Color. Last year, many organizations committed to solidarity with BIPOC individuals. One Northern Illinois art institution realized they needed outside help to uphold their pledge. Yvonne Booz explains.
Barry Troy is the Director of Education and Exhibitions at the Freeport Art Museum. He says he took an equity, diversity, and inclusion course as an administrator, but realized more was needed.
I think all of that happened with George Floyd and everything, I think it refocused the energies of museums around the world and other arts organizations towards doing more work.
Troy says he worked with people of color in the community, but it was mostly youth. He explains Black families were not coming to the museum. He reached out to a downstate artist, Patrick Earl Hammy, to ask him to take part in a show. But the conversation with this Black creative extended to other things.
In working with Patrick, this BIPOC initiative document evolved.
The BIPOC initiative ensures that artists of color have exhibitions at the museum for the next 5 years. The first artist selects another artist, and then that artist chooses the next one, and so on. Hammy is a visual artist and associate professor at the University of Illinois. He says he told Troy that for changes to occur, things will have to be changed from the top down.
And so one suggestion I had was like, you know, the board. Is there any people of color on the board? The answer at the time was no. And so, you know, we halted the conversation and a couple months went by. He got back to me and they had made movement.
I established a committee of exhibitions committee with three people of color on it. It's part of getting voices heard. And so I guess I took some, moved in some very practical ways and worked on those with Patrick.
Troy says he had to take himself out of the selection process. The exhibition committee makes the final approval after the displaying artist makes their pick. Jessica Modica is the executive director of the museum. She explains that the establishment, like many others, has worked on being more inclusive over the years. Like Troy, she says recent events revealed that what was being done, including sometimes having BIPOC guest curators, just wasn't enough.
And one of the areas that we continue to struggle with is that we've noticed that we don't have as many people of color that are involved in our exhibitions, are submitting their work to be shown in the museums.
The BIPOC initiative was one way to tackle that problem. In addition to Hammy working on the initiative with Troy, he is also one of the first artists to take part. His exhibit is called I Am Legend. He says Black and white people have totally different outlooks on certain things, and he wants to show how what could be considered Black excellence could be something haunting for whites. He used the TV show Soul Train as one example.
And so Soul Train becomes the embodiment of their psychic terror, of what we might become, of what we could achieve, right? It's an embodiment of that terror.
Hammy chose Tiana Bowie as the next artist. He didn't know her personally, but says he was in awe of her work. Bowie is an artist and educator. She's from Chicago, but now spends her time between Detroit and Milwaukee. Bowie's art for the show focuses on the voice of Black women. Her exhibit is called Embodiment or Embodiments. She says her art changed focus during the pandemic when she became engrossed in social media and came across the app Reface.
And I'm embodying, in particular, Black women who are giving speeches, and there's all this controversy. And I notice there's a lot of controversy when a Black woman makes a stance and says no.
Modica says in addition to the exhibitions, other things are underway. The exhibition opened last month and will continue through February 12th. I'm Yvonne Bulls.
We have more ahead here on Statewide, an exhibit based on a famous play. That story is next. And if you want to see a piece of history up close, the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Museum putting its original handwritten copy of the Gettysburg Address on display this month. That document is one of just five that exist. The viewing will continue until November 30th. The museum also launching a new web tool to make it easier for anyone to study the address in detail. You can head to the website presidentlincoln.illinois.gov/Gettysburg Address to find out more details. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. An art exhibit is exploring themes set in the Chicago-based play A Raisin in the Sun by Lorraine Hansberry. Local and international artists wrestle with the idea of home in a gallery. Natalie Moore paid a visit to speak with the curator of the exhibit, simply titled Reason.
I wasn't sure how to... Hi!
6018 North is a gallery that used to be a mansion. When I enter the foyer, there is a door that I can't seem to open.
So I'm standing in front of this off-white door with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 door knobs, and I can't get in. Okay, Trisha, I give up.
Founder and artistic director Trisha Van Eck coaches me from the second level. She tells me to push the other side. It opens easily. I never thought to try to enter on the left. This is an art piece with symbolism.
It shows that inequity that's built into the system that people don't necessarily, even artists from an art, like artists struggle and think, like, but people who know the art world, they just push, they just go in. Same with any system, it's designed, it's not necessarily designed to keep out, but that's what it effect does because this is all super distracting.
The piece is left over from another exhibit, but it appropriately stayed for Raisin, a rumination on race and place. Asha Iman Veal is the curator of Raisin.
One of our largest spaces is the Younger's living room it has been transported into. I think that's one of the most iconic things about the play. It's such a simple set, but again, even across locations and theater companies and film companies, it's so easy to restage.
The Youngers were an intergenerational Black family living on the south side of Chicago in a cramped apartment. In the play, the Youngers receive a financial windfall and seek to buy a home in a white neighborhood. Problem is, the White Neighborhood Association doesn't want them. Playwright Lorraine Hansberry drew from her own Southside experiences. The groundbreaking drama debuted on Broadway in 1959. Before Veal gives me a tour of the three-story gallery featuring 37 artists, she tells me the process that brought this show together. While in graduate school back in 2016, Veal came across a series of images by a Polish scholar of African-American literature who was looking at A Raisin in the Sun being done in Eastern Europe in the 1960s.
And the thing that was striking to me about this archive that the researcher had looked at was that these were all done in blackface. So again, I think there are a lot of immediate reactions and emotions that come up, but mine was actually curiosity.
Veal moved past the minstrel nature to try to understand why Raisin in the Sun resonated with global appreciation. Even through my mask, Veal sees the shock in my face at all these photos of blackface from various productions.
There were a lot of different political reasons. There was the thought about Black Americans at that particular history and time as being a force of rebellion or resistance against a larger, you know, American capitalism. There were ties to communism, obviously, in the community during that time. Lorraine was hugely popular in the region. Another piece we have is Chicago history. So Zakiya Najiba Dumas O'Neill is an amazing artist in town and is speaking about their family history and having a Black architect in the family, which is, again, today there are not that many fully, you know, licensed, registered Black architects, and this is something her grandfather was doing mid-last century. She has a piece that I really love that's called What Space Was Made for Us to Feel Like. Another artist who's thinking about home outside of the city of Chicago but used to live in Chicago is Ziwan Yang. Ziwan grew up in Beijing, is queer, and wanted to think about heteronormativity within domesticity. So in their photo practice, the parents gender swap.
On the second floor, the walls are painted an intentional color.
Chicago-based artist Amanda Williams in the Sherwin-Williams color Raisin Purple. Amanda has a question that says, you know, what would housing segregation look like, or what color is housing segregation? And it is purple. It is this Raisin Purple.
Back downstairs, two videos play from choreographer Kiara King as feminist homages to Benita, the fiercely independent and educated sister in A Raisin in the Sun. King explains this tribute to Act Two, Scene Two, a physical reenactment of angst and movement after she rejects advances from a potential suitor.
Benita, she was a character that honestly I felt really connected to, just with trying to find herself, trying to do more than what people expected of what she can do and who she can be.
Outside on the front porch, artist Kyle Bellucci Johansson is putting finishing touches on his piece. He spells out phrases with grass seeds on 66 welcome mats. The words come from a white member of the neighborhood association in the play.
He is constantly smiling. He's sweating, not from heat, but from anxiety. And he's delivering the most horrible racist news through this, like, polite, smiling face.
Those fertilized seeds will turn into long green grass that will grow up through the mats. Visitors will trample the grass, which will go through a whole life cycle during the course of the Raisin exhibition.
That's Natalie Moore with that report. Farm tractors are supposed to be used in the field, but sometimes farmers drive their tractors on highways when they need to get from one field to another, and that's when sometimes deadly problems can arise. With harvest season approaching in the fall, Rich Egger told us about one woman's effort to remind drivers to share the road. And we share that story again today.
A lifelong farmer in western Illinois, Tim Sullivan, was driving his tractor on a stretch of highway north of Macomb a few years ago when he was struck from behind by a box truck. The impact threw Sullivan from his tractor, killing him. He was 64.
He loved farming. It made him happy, and he got to do that every day.
This is his youngest daughter, Teresa Young. She says as their family drove from the memorial service to the cemetery, they were comforted to see the route lined with tractors of all sizes and even lawnmowers as the community's farmers paid their respects.
It really made that drive after the service a memorable one and a beautiful one.
And the sight sparked an idea in artist Kelly Quinn, a lifelong Macomb resident.
The image of all those tractors at the intersections really struck me.
Quinn says Sullivan was respected and loved in the community. She wanted to use art to honor him and remind people to share the road with tractors. But she knew she needed help to turn a brown, crumpled 1939 Farmall tractor into a colorful monument covered in mosaic tiles.
I typically use this material. It lasts longer than paint, and it's a little bit fresher and newer looking.
It took a couple years of donations of money, materials, and time, but on a sunny and warm late summer afternoon, Kelly Quinn unveiled her latest piece of art, Tractor Town. A mosaic with tiles of every color of the rainbow and more cover the tractor, painting pictures of farm fields, wind turbines, and puffy white clouds. Quinn believes this work of art is one of a kind.
Yeah, anywhere in the world, nobody has mosaic a tractor before. So it's a special first, and it'll be neat that it is from Macomb.
The mosaic tractor now stands at the intersection of two highways and a train crossing near downtown Macomb.
We're looking at trying to prevent any future deaths by making Macomb a place where there is awareness through a very unique project of mosaicing antique tractors and putting them on pillars so people see them.
Tractor accidents are by far the leading cause of death and serious injury in agriculture, according to the National Ag Safety Database. Around 250 people die each year from tractor overturns, runovers, entanglement, and highway collisions. Josie Rudolphi, who researches agricultural safety and health at the University of Illinois, says despite the dangers, farmers use tractors just about every single day.
We do know that farmers are very aware of the numerous hazards involved with their work.
but they often consider those hazards part of the job.
And part of the job sometimes means using public roads to get from one field to another, especially in the spring and fall. Ridolfi says some states, such as Illinois, now require new farm machinery to include flashing amber lights and red reflectors. A colorful array of lights festoon the Mosaic tractor. Teresa Young says the Sullivan family is touched by the project. In fact, she was one of around a dozen volunteers who helped piece together the mosaic, including a depiction of the family's sesquicentennial farm.
That's really a special thing for us to have and do and show our children.
The artist, Kelly Quinn, hopes the project will get people talking.
The talking about it is really important. If people are thinking about tractors more, maybe there'll be fewer accidents.
Quinn says she's not done reminding truck and car drivers to think about tractors. Her goal is to mosaic several more tractors and display them around Macomb. I'm Rich Egger.
Randy Witter is retiring from the Illinois State House after nearly a half century as a lobbyist. Caroline Kamzanski spoke with him as he was cleaning out his office to hear about his time under the Capitol Dome.
Randy Witter picked up my phone call from a snowstorm of papers. Over 48 years in the State House while working on everything from the Clean Indoor Air Act to the recent Climate and Equitable Jobs Act, Witter's amassed a lot of hard copies. He's kept the preference for print, even as the legislature has moved toward pixels. Witter's not convinced that the pivot to paperless and remote lawmaking is an upgrade.
I use the analogy of watching baseball over the television or going to the stadium and watching baseball, and while watching over the television, you can get very, very specific and you can see the batters and the catchers and the pitchers pretty much up close, but you don't have the feeling of the grandeur of the stadium as a whole.
One consequence of that is a faster pace of legislating. Now that lawmakers can file proposals and amendments with a few clicks, Witter says the pace of business under the dome has become almost frenetic. He's not sure this is a good thing either.
While I think it's good that we have this kind of technology, there are occasions when it really needs to simmer. A particular idea needs a little bit more time before the vote is cast.
Witter fell into lobbying as a law student when a former professor asked him to follow some lobbyists for a day and report back on what they were doing. Soon after that, he switched from law to public administration studies at what's now the University of Illinois Springfield. There, he met his future business partner, Bob Cook. After a stint with the Illinois Association of Realtors, Cook and Witter formed their lobbying firm in 1985. Witter is aware of the public perception of lobbyists, which he describes as
little pot-bellied men sneaking around the back hallways, wearing their pinky rings, chomping on a cigar and carrying big bags of money.
Witter says the lobbyist's real role in this process is a lot less sensational.
A lobbyist is really a communication link between a particular interest, be it a union, an association, a corporation, an association, and the lawmaking process.
Over years of participating in that process, Witter has also watched the shape of Springfield itself change as more and more of the state offices and workers were moved to Chicago.
When I came to Springfield in 1973, there were still many, many agencies that had either their headquarters or a major operation in Springfield, as well as the Chicago or the suburbs of Cook County. Today, a number of agencies have pretty much moved lock, stock, and barrel to the Chicagoland area.
Witter has seen problems that take the work of generations to even get a dent in them. Campaign finance is one of those.
There's been a lot of legislation and now laws in regards to the disclosure of who's giving money to whom and how much money is being given and are there limitations on those monies.
Despite the flurry of sunshine laws and calls for transparency, he says the recent federal-level legal decisions have probably made the path an even steeper one than it was.
The Supreme Court ruling on 501c4 organizations not having to disclose who's given money to the political action committee of a 501c4 has thrown a monkey wrench in the whole thing. That whole process is very, very hard to address.
Witter also thinks trust in government has declined during his career, which spanned the 1974 impeachment effort that led to the resignation of President Richard Nixon, and more recently the ongoing federal investigation of former House Speaker Michael Madigan.
There's more cynicism and probably more suspicion of government because of some of the sensational allegations that have been made, as well as some of the actual facts that have come out.
That said, he thinks the suspicion isn't entirely a bad thing.
There's a degree of willingness to challenge things. New ideas are good.
And while Witter sees things that need challenging in Illinois, he thinks the legislature will be part of the solution. And he'll be watching, albeit from a different perspective, for the first time in decades. I'm Caroline Kubnansky.
Well, that's all the time we have for Statewide this week. We're thankful you tuned in to hear reports and conversations from in and around Illinois, and we look forward to bringing more to you. We'll be back next week. If you miss any of our episodes, find them all at nprillinois.org. Just look for Statewide, or listen to our podcast through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.